it's me. Welcome to the 21st and penultimate episode of the 5th season of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 4th of December, and in this episode we're going to
Oops.
Yes, we need to fill that in. We will, of course, cover the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, tomorrow's technology today, and go over your feedback. If you're listening live, hello, you can send us messages using the chat facility on our website and in the IRC channel. I'm Alan, and joining me tonight is Tony.
Hello.
Laura.
Hello.
And Mark.
Hello.
Tony, what have you been up to?
I can't remember what I wrote down. I went up to... Oh, I was moonlighting. Doctor
In
Who...
In public.
Indeed, yes. Actually, yes. On the Doctor Who podcast.
I saw you on YouTube.
Yes, I was on YouTube and...
Oh, you're that Tony Whitmore.
Yeah, I'm the internet's Tony Whitmore, I think you'll find. Yeah, moonlighting on that, and we did a little review, went to see a recovered Doctor Who episode up in London on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun, hanging out with my Doctor Who friends, much cooler than Ubuntu friends, obviously. And I also just bought...
Might as well go home.
I also managed to get hold of a Nexus 4.
Ooh. Where is it? I can't see it.
Not
that looks like an
HTC
Hero you have there.
A very battered and worn HTC Hero. It will be here in 1 to 2 weeks, according to Google.
Oh, right, cool.
So it went back on sale again today.
Are you going to give that away on the podcast?
Five. Nope. Oh. I'm going to give away the battered HTC Hero.
No, you won't.
With all your attention.
It's not yours.
Oh, yeah, Alan might want it back.
Excellent. Laura, how about yourself? What have you been up to?
I went to a bike maintenance workshop.
Really?
And how is your back?
Bike.
Oh, I see.
Bicycle. Yes.
What did you learn?
I learned how to adjust the gears on my bike, how to take the wheel off and remove the tyre, deflate it, reinflate it, everything. Clean the brake. Oh, I filed my brake blocks.
Right, like you do.
So, yeah. I think the bit I was most proud of was tweaking the gears, because it just sounded like a complicated thing to do and it wasn't.
was this like a night school kind of thing?
It was a 2-hour workshop at a bike place in rideride.co.uk in Southampton. And it was subsidised by Sustrans, which I think is a charity, national charity for sustainable transport.
Oh, right. Were there many people there? Was it one-on-one? Or
there were about 4 of us there, I think.
Men, women?
Mix. Half
oh, right.
and half.
Cool.
So that was really cool.
Useful. You feel confident fixing your own bike now?
Yes.
Would you fix someone else's bike?
No.
Damn it.
It was a very basic one, though.
Ah, cool. Mark, how about yourself? What have you been up to?
Well, always keen to keep up with the latest trends. I started playing Minecraft.
You started?
Yes.
2.5 years after everybody else.
Yes.
Excellent.
Did
well
you
done.
Build a pig or whatever it is you're supposed to do?
I
punch trees.
I hit some pigs. And kept on falling in lava and burning all my stuff until I worked out that if I jump out of the lava, then I drop it somewhere, it doesn't all catch fire when I die.
Okay.
And I've
means nothing to me.
Built some houses and abandoned them in favour of a house I haven't built yet.
Do you see you can get Lego Minecraft?
Yes.
They have to make the Lego more blocky.
Awesome.
Right. And I also donated to Wikipedia.
Oh.
Me too.
Why? Just to get rid of those annoying banners?
Well, no. If
does it get rid of them?
If you don't have to donate. You just have to log in, and then you don't see them.
Ah.
But I thought I use it every day. Why not give them a fiver each month? So I did.
I just gave them a tenner.
Fair enough.
Wow.
So, Alan, the second most popular Pontifex on Twitter, what have you been doing?
Bless you. I went to the post office to post a podcast prize.
Oh, right. Okay. We haven't done a competition recently, have we?
No. This is a prize that's been sat on a shelf that I kind of neglected to post before I went to Copenhagen for UDS.
That sounds most unlike you.
And then again, neglected to post it when I got back.
This has never happened before, has it? Surely.
One or two times, yes. It goes into the shelf of interesting things and stays there.
Right.
What was most interesting about it was the fact that I posted it and then discovered I posted it to the wrong person, which was kind of annoying, given I'd actually wrapped it up really, really nicely and then walked around the post office, you know, really
being
happy,
a bit smug,
and having a stroll. And I thought I was almost going to send you a text from the post office or a tweet with a photo of me handing the parcel over. I wanted to take a photo of the guy like accepting my parcel, but I decided not to. And then so.
But we made sure the right person got it as well.
And then within minutes, Tony sent an email.
Yeah, saying, have you sent that parcel yet?
Yes.
You sent it to the wrong one person.
Yes. Whoever thought we might be a professional outfit, clearly deluded.
Well, two people got a prize.
Yes, congratulations.
Excellent. Yeah, well done, both of you. Yes.
Let's not go into...
That won't happen again.
Yeah.
We've seen people and companies looking at alternatives to Android, Windows and iOS. We've got Jolla, which is made up from...
Jolla.
Your Jolla?
Oh, they're Finnish,
isn't it? Yes. Made from ex-Nokia employees.
made from... mashed up.
Is that what Nokia did?
We've got Tizen, is it? Or Tizen? I'm never sure.
Yes, Tizen.
Tizen,
yes.
Like Tizer with an N. From Intel. And Bada from Samsung.
Bada.
From Samsung.
And we've also seen independent crowdfunded projects offering alternatives. So is crowdsourcing the way to fund competition to Android, Windows and iOS? Or does it have to have a big company like Nokia or Intel behind it to make it a success?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So crowdsourcing. Hands up on this podcast if you've been if you've crowdsourced something, been involved in a crowdsourcing thing.
Tony, okay. Laura, and no, not Tony. Oh dear, that narration didn't work. Sorry,
Alan, Mark, and Laura put their hands up. So 3 out of 4 of you have been. So what sort of things have you been involved in crowdfunding, sourcing, whatever it's called?
I've crowdfunded some music projects.
Okay, what sort of things, like albums or something?
Yes, triple albums.
Triple albums.
Wow.
So yes. Somebody wants to go into a studio, they need funding to pay for the studio time in advance.
Yeah, basically, they artist called Ginger Wildheart, who doesn't have a record deal. He just has a lot of musicians that he knows. So he wanted to essentially hire a studio, pay all his mates as session musicians, record it, give away any extra money to charity, and put the album out.
So in this case, his fans are paying a certain amount of money up front to help fund the making of the album,
yeah.
And then what?
And they get a reward. They get a copy of the album, basically.
I will buy the album regardless of what it sounds like.
So
here's the money up front.
It's just kind of
prepaying,
yes.
Yeah, pre-ordering. Okay. But
before the thing exists, in some cases.
Right.
Sometimes it's after the thing exists. So, you know, all the R&D work has already been done and, you know, the thing exists, but they just need to ramp up production. They're all in different stages, all these crowdsource projects.
Right.
Some of them don't exist at all other than engineering drawings or something.
So yes. What sort of things have you... backed?
Mostly tangible items that people will post to me at some point. as opposed to
competition prizes.
So one that I'm quite looking forward to getting is one called it's a book called I Draw Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book that shows you how to draw comic characters and stuff as you go through, so you can like actually follow along with the book and actually write comics. And a few others as well. There's an engineering toy for girls that I thought my daughter might like.
Is it pink?
It's got pink bits. Mm. It's also got blue bits. So
why is it not for boys?
I'm going to pass on that.
Plenty of boys in engineering.
Yeah. Most of them are techie type things, I think, that I've done.
Did you get the Pebble?
No, I think that was before my time on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I didn't really follow that.
So if something has reached a target or its period of... bids has closed, you can't get involved in it?
No. Well, so there's a period of time. It depends. There's a number of different ways of doing it. If you use the official Kickstarter, there's one way. There's one called Indiegogo, and there's loads of others starting up. But then some companies do their own. They say it's crowdsourced. For example, app.net, the Twitter comparison thing.
Yes.
They did their own crowdsource thing, but they didn't use any third-party sites. They did it all on their own page.
Right.
And there was one company who... Kickstarter wouldn't let them on their site, so they wrote and open sourced their own crowdfunding site system. So you can you can now download their system if you want to run your own crowdfunding site.
Right. So there's loads of different ways to do it, and often when the period of time ends, if the amount of money hasn't been raised, then nobody gets their money, and you probably don't get the product.
Right.
Or the product may not get developed as fast or at all.
So at what point do you part with your money?
When at the end of the crowdfunding, if the goal has been reached, then they can then take the money and make the thing. And
So I see a website for a widget of some sort, and it's asking for, let's say, $10. And I commit to giving $10 at the end of the fundraising window, which might be a couple of months.
But you give your financial details. Yeah. It's not like a pledge. It's not like a phone-in where you pledge and then you might actually give the money or you might not. Right. They actually take your details and will take your money when the time comes.
Yeah. Okay, assuming you don't cancel your credit card in the in-between.
Yeah. And assuming that enough other people say, I will also give £10.
Okay, so there's a threshold.
They have to reach their target by the end, otherwise they don't get anyone's money.
It's very much like the way you helped finance ORG.
Right.
I'll give £5 if 1,000 other people give £5. Effectively, that's like the simplest term, where there's only one amount of money you need to specify and there's a fixed number of people who contribute. Whereas with Kickstarter, they often have different bands. So you could just give $1 and you'll get nothing but the gratitude that you contributed.
Right.
Or you could give like $1,000 and they might fly you out there and have dinner with the people who are making the thing.
Okay.
You know, but they all set their own level. But you're not actually you're never actually buying the thing. You're contributing to the campaign, and then as a reward, you get a thing in return. I'm sure there's some tax reason for doing it that way.
It sounds a bit like Odd Camp, where we ask for donations to get in.
To get a T-shirt.
Yeah, and you get a free mug.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly the same kind of scam. I mean, deal.
Right, okay.
So it's not just technical things. There's lots of books out there now. And Robert Llewellyn, off of Red Dwarf, wrote a whole novel, which was very good. And I actually missed the crowdsourcing part of it. But Dr. Black, who saved Bletchley Park with other people, has written a book about saving Bletchley Park, or is writing a book, and she's crowdsourced the funding for that, and I think she's hit 150% or something.
So Sue Black, I think we did Sue interview Black, last season before maybe, about Bletchley Park. One of the things I have heard is that you get these projects that massively overreach their targets.
Mm. So, for example, the game console, Ouya, or how you pronounce it, O-U-Y-A,
They had
a target of $950,000, and by the end of the period, they got $8.5 million.
Wow!
So somewhat oversubscribed.
The first album I did, it doesn't. In fact, on Pledge Music, which is the site I used, or rather Ginger Wildheart used, it doesn't actually tell you the amount of money that the artist is asking for. It just tells you the percentage of the total they've reached.
Right.
And so that project reached about 570% of its target, which
That's what Unbound do. So saving Bletchley Park's 157%. Mm.
Okay.
So there's a lot of these that are hardware. There's books, there's music, but there's a fair number of them that are hardware devices. Mm. And we mentioned one a little while ago, a phone that...
Next Phone.
Next Phone. It was on Indiegogo and it didn't make anywhere near the target.
No, it made about... $100 or something.
It was like $3,000.
Out of nearly a million.
Yeah.
So what governs whether a project will drastically exceed its target or fail miserably?
Well, I think the real difference between something like the PengPod, which is one we talked about last week, which has passed its target and gone past it by quite a way, and something like the Next Phone, is with the PengPod, they said, look at these tablets that we've got in our hands. We're running Linux on them. We just need to sort out the last few bits and get them shipped. Whereas Next Phone was basically some nice concept art.
Mm.
And the other thing, the perks with PengPod were, if you donate this much, then we'll give you one of the devices. Whereas with Next Phone, there was no offer of actually ever getting a device for the money. So we basically wanted $1 million for in exchange for some concept art.
Right. So
the theory was that it would get made at some point and then it would be something that you could buy. But you were funding the development of the thing and rather than the manufacture and production and distribution, which is what you're doing with the PengPod.
Yeah.
So you'd fund it and then pay again to buy it in the future if it succeeded.
Yeah, and you might get early doors or a deal, that wasn't clear.
No, there wasn't actually any concrete offer of what you'd get in the long run. You might get that's probably it. It was high risk.
Whereas ones like there was a one that I funded on Kickstarter was the Ostrich Pillow.
Oh yes.
Yes, which I saw on TV, Stephen Fry's Gadget Man show.
Oh, really? Seriously?
Had it on. Yeah.
They haven't even sent them out to backers yet.
Well, they have to Stephen Fry.
Yeah, there's a few. There's been on a few TV programs. It's kind of getting.
What is it?
It's
Alan shows laptop to Laura.
It's a pillow Well, it's more like a snood thing. You pull over your head and
it
covers your eyes.
Because it's nothing like one of those.
A snood is like a thing you pull over your head. It's like a like a tube.
No, it's not. It's a scarf which doesn't have an end.
Yes, but you pull it over your head. It's a tube. Back in the 80s, Mark, we used to do this. We used to pull snoods over our heads.
Okay.
So it's a tube. You pull over your head. It covers your eyes and it's got two holes. You put your hands in, you put your head on the desk and you go to sleep.
You look a lot like Monica, was it, off of Friends with a turkey on her head.
Yes.
I suspect that was the inspiration.
The thing that got me with that one is they had a kind of early bird thing where they had a limited number of backers. I think it was only 300 if you pledge the absolute lowest and you get one early, whereas if you pledge more, you know, you might be in the second round, production round or something like that. So there are some where your motivation is not just to fund the thing but to actually have one of the things, then you know you're going to be more motivated to stick your money in it. If there's a nice early doors, you know, if you're a kind of impatient person like me. Whereas if for the phone, that next phone, because there was no way I was ever going to get one by pledging to it, directly, that, and there was no early backer kind of thing. It was kind of, well, I'll just sit and wait. And
this doesn't give you any kind of ongoing stake in the company. It's literally just a cash injection for them, and you get something back in return.
And you get the fuzzy feeling that you may have, you know, helped someone bootstrap a business of some kind.
Okay.
You know.
Well, Victor 1998 is listening live, and he's commenting in the IRC channel saying it could take your money, and there's no guarantee you'll get anything in the end. It's kind of no guarantee of getting a physical product.
That sometimes happens. Yeah.
In fact, okay. Andy Piper, friend of the show,
indeed,
has been moaning about this on Twitter a bit this week because he's had a bit of trouble with some of the projects that he's backed,
not shipping
very quickly.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah, there was one that raised their target back in March this year, and they still haven't shipped the item. It was the cloud, what's it called, the egg,
air quality egg
right. thing.
Yeah.
Andy Piper invested in something called an air quality egg.
it looked cool, that's the thing, you know.
Yeah. Right, okay, that's the main thing. If he wants to buy an egg from me for 50 quid, then I'm sure I can.
Then you'll guarantee it's air quality.
I'll drive it up to his house.
So I don't know if these will... they work for some things, and they also work well for games.
Yeah.
Especially games where people have a proven track record of creating games in the past.
Although saying that, we mentioned in the news a few weeks ago about Elite Dangerous, the new remake of... And that's got a month to go, but it's only reached half of its target.
Yeah, true. Some of them do have a spurt towards the end, you know, much like an eBay auction. You know,
I think if you've got some credibility behind you, that helps. Like the Robert Llewellyn one, he's written books before. You've got a fair chance he's going to write it.
Yeah,
but surely the advantage of this sort of system is that you don't have to have a track record to get your product to market. If you had a good track record, you're probably more likely to be able to go to a publisher and get your thing published.
But you may not want to. You may not want to use that system.
Yeah. Some of the games that are published via these systems or advertised via these systems or funded often don't want to go via that mechanism because of the restrictions that are imposed, you know, on their creativity, darling.
Right.
And so they'd rather be in total control of the thing that they're creating themselves.
Okay.
It's a bit like the Kevin Smith thing, marketing his own film by just taking the old route and going around America with it.
Right.
But then he's going to help new people get on board using his name because they don't have the name already. So.
Okay. So if people are vaguely interested in finding out more about this sort of crowdsourcing funding thing, where should they start?
I would browse Kickstarter and Indiegogo.
And unbound.co.uk.
And pledgemusic.com.
Wow, we should put links to all of these.
In the show notes.
Let me write them down while I remember.
Right, okay. And what sort of amount are you talking about to get involved? Is it like $1 or...?
The minimum on some of them is $1.
But you don't get anything for that.
Well, so for example, the Ouya, the game console, the minimum was $10. And the reward was you get to select your own username. So if you ever do buy one, you know, some people like to have their own game tag nickname in their online system. So they, you know, you can reserve your own nickname. But then it goes up to having like badges or emblems or, you know, things like... Then there's actually getting the device and then a special version of the device or a developer version of the device.
Or knitted socks.
Or, you know, or Or there's, you know, for this one, there was, if you pledge $5,000, we'll put you up in a San Francisco for a day with, you know, the people who designed the thing. So it depends, you know, how passionate you are about wanting the thing to succeed, whatever it is, and how much money you've got to, you know, throw at something speculatively.
Well, if you're listening at home and have got any thoughts about crowdfunding and whether it's a good idea or a bad idea or somewhere in between.
And whether we could use it for Ubuntu. I know it's been speculated whether...
Or OggCamp.
Or UUPC.
Oh, yes, definitely.
We've got lots of postage to pay.
We'll do another season for only £10,000 each. Yes, you can email in podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. It's time for the news, and Mozilla engineering manager Benjamin Smedberg has decided to disable 64-bit builds of Firefox for Windows. The reasons cited included lack of plugin support and lack of resources assigned to 64-bit development, leading to user frustration. Users currently running the 64-bit edition will be automatically migrated to the 32-bit version, which will still run on the 64-bit operating system.
There was a bit of uproar, and some people complained and said, well, why don't you just leave them enabled for, you know, a point in time in the future when we do have the engineers available to do the QA and the testing and, you know,
get have them kind of unsupported releases.
Yeah, just let it build, you know, because it's already building. Why not just carry on letting it build? No, they kind of just said, nope, we're not building it.
Is the advantage of a 64-bit version that it can address more than 4 gigs of memory?
That's quite a lot for a browser.
A lot of tabs.
Yeah.
And also keeping only 64-bit clean, so you're only using 64-bit libraries.
True, so you don't need
you don't have to have
compatibility layer.
A 32-bit version of a library and a 64-bit version of a library in memory at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, well, if it's only for Windows, I don't care.
Well, there is that. Yeah.
A new version of the GStreamer SDK has been released, including support for GStreamer on Android. The release aims to allow production of Android apps with advanced multimedia capabilities, and the SDK supports Android 2.3.1 and up, although hardware-accelerated features will only be available from Android 4.1.
So should this make it easier for people to port apps across from normal Linux to Android Linux?
I suppose so. Jacosha on the Nexus 7.
Yeah. Get on it, Jono.
Mozilla has started shipping builds of Firefox for Android supporting H.264 video streaming. The move comes after Mozilla's policy change earlier this year in which it decided to support the patent-encumbered codec when it was already present on user systems. Mobile devices support H.264 through hardware codecs, but future releases will add support on desktop releases through software codecs as well.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
I think so.
So that would mean you could do YouTube with the HTML5.
Yes.
Although most mobile devices detect you're on YouTube and redirect you to an app, usually, but you could do it directly in the browser.
Yeah. And when you've got, I think it's, is it GStreamer on Linux or something else?
Uh-huh.
Which has, yeah, so if basically if
it'll
you
pass off to the codecs.
Yes, exactly. So therefore installed. They don't have to build the codec into the browser. They just use what's already there, and therefore
that makes total
that's
sense.
Sort of still within there.
It's all evil, but it makes total sense if a person's already gone through the hoops of having the codec on their system or it's already built into the hardware, why not use it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm glad you understand that.
An Austrian man has been arrested and charged after his server running a Tor exit node was used for sharing child pornography. William Weber had his house raided by police and his hardware confiscated and is currently awaiting trial. Facing up to 10 years in jail if convicted, he's requested donations to allow him to hire a lawyer to fight his case.
So this isn't cool.
No,
so
it's quite scary, isn't it?
Sucks quite a bit.
Explain what a Tor exit node is.
So Tor is the onion router. Which allows people to browse the internet without people knowing what IP address they originated from.
Yeah. So it's basically it's a sort of proxy network which sends your traffic around several servers in an encrypted form. So, well, basically it looks like the traffic to the destination is coming from wherever it exits that network.
So this guy hasn't been downloading child pornography himself.
And he's not accused of that.
Yeah.
And it's not... Right, but he's being held responsible for the actions of the
machine. He's being responsible for distributing it because his machine accessed it, essentially.
Right. Yeah. A machine he was in control of, despite him not originating the packets because they came through Tor and then left at the exit point that was on his machine.
Yeah, and we have laws in this country that do something similar, make the ISP, or the Internet Service Provider, whether that's a company or a big organisation like a university or whatever, responsible for what happens on that connection.
Mm. And same for home. If you left your wireless access point open, or and someone sat outside your house or in a coffee shop over the road from your flat and accessed your network, right, and then did something dodgy, it's entirely possible that some police could raid your house and take away all your equipment,
which is a massive waste of their resources.
Yes. And it seems from his account that when he spoke to the authorities, they kind of understood and got what he was talking about and understood it. But the problem is they now have to go through the whole process, and the chances are he probably will never get his equipment back.
And he'll have a criminal record.
Well, no, even if he's acquitted.
Oh, yeah.
Even if he's not charged, and it
will have cost him a boatload of lawyers and
and he's lost time, all his computer equipment and tarnished his name,
Yeah.
But it's a case that needs to be seen and needs to be made more public. So, in some ways, it's a good thing, because on the positive side, people are now more aware of Tor and more aware of the implication of running a Tor exit node.
Yeah.
Indie City, a distribution and achievements portable for independent games, has announced that it is planning to release for Linux and is seeking launch titles.
Cool.
Oh, this is Indie City. It's like Steam and Desura, isn't
right,
it?
Yes, I thought it looked like that sort of thing.
Yes,
but
so it's
for
like a game portal.
Only for indie titles.
Yes, like Humble Bundle is only for indie games.
Except for the new one.
Yes.
Good stuff. Okay, that's the end of the news.
Cool.
And we have an event.
Ooh. Tell us about the event.
Okay, the Hacker Public Radio New Year Party is happening.
When is it?
It is starting on Monday the 31st of December 2012.
That would make sense, being a New Year party.
At 12 o'clock UTC, so midday, and running until 12 o'clock on Tuesday the 1st of January, so a 24-hour party, people. Join the live session in the Hacker Public Radio room on mumble.openspeak.cc and port 64747.
Maybe in the show notes, I imagine.
Or listen along to the live stream. So Ken Fallon has emailed in to ask us to promote this.
Yep.
And he genuinely wants people to come along and listen to them talk on New Year's
and
Eve.
And join in as well.
And join in.
It's really easy. You just install Mumble, point it at their server, mumble.openspeak.cc on that port 64747, and you join the channel and you can chat with them, and they're recording it, and then they'll put it out as a show shortly after.
Cool. So if your social life is somewhat lacking, you can spend some time with talking other to other people whose social lives are somewhat lacking.
Meow.
I'm sure it'll be great fun, Ken.
Lots of people don't like me.
Says the man with a recording studio in his front room.
Yes. Talking to internet people.
Touché.
Hello, and welcome to Tomorrow's Technology Today. I'm Douglas Austin Cambridge. Good day to all our listeners, wherever you are around the British Empire, or indeed, Licky N.
Good day, Douglas.
That will be our hasty hostess, Miss Deirdre Morris Oxford. And why are you in such a hurry this fine day?
We have a guest, and he's bringing in his latest invention.
Why, certainly we do, Deirdre. None other than my old school chum, the noted explorer, Major Herbert Maxwell Fosdyke Curmudgeon. And that splendid invention you can hear is... Well, Major, why don't you tell us about it?
Top hole, old boy. Yes, this is my new all-terrain vehicle. Dashed expensive, I can tell you.
Why is that?
Mostly for the 200 pairs of army boots it moves about on.
Wouldn't caterpillar tracks be more efficient?
This is a British expedition. What does efficiency have to do with it?
What do you call it, Herbert?
I call it my snowmobile. Going to take it up the Amazon next month.
There's no snow along the Amazon, Major.
Well spotted, girl. I like the cut of your petticoat. Perhaps I could take you up the Amazon, midair.
Oh, Major Curmudgeon, I couldn't possibly. How exciting. I'll start pecking.
Snow, swamp, sand, it's all the same to me in the mobile. This is the final test before we take it up the Andes in search of the abominable snowman.
Isn't the abominable snowman in Nepal? Wouldn't it be easier simply to fly, Herbert? In an aeroplane?
Like those damned sissy boys in the RAF? Unsafe. unsound. It's madness, I tell you. No son of mine will be joining the RAF.
Your brother Gordon is in the RAF, isn't he?
He crashed.
But he survived. He's being looked after by your wife in Chipping Sodbury.
Gordon's alive? Gah!
So what do you intend to do with the abominable snowman when you find him, Herbert?
Bag him and stick him in London Zoo where he belongs, Florence.
You promised you wouldn't call me that, Herbert. We're not at school anymore. Right, that's it. I've just about had it.
Douglas! Douglas, put down that bottle of scotch! Douglas, where's your medication? Oh, dear. Well, that's all from tomorrow's technology today. Toodle pip and God save the king.
So we got to wondering over our tea and cake, why do we do this?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I wonder that every time I drive down.
So we and many other people spend a lot of our hours voluntarily working on Ubuntu. But what is it about Ubuntu that's so appealing? And why Ubuntu and not some other open source project? And why Ubuntu and not going to the pub?
Okay. Right. So, why? Why?
It's a good question.
The usual developer answer is to scratch an itch, isn't it? It's, you know, I created this thing and I wanted to solve a problem, so I solved it, and I'm putting it out there so other people can use it, or because I want help with it.
I'm not that itchy.
Okay, yes, you are. You're itchy in the hospital department. You quite like theme hospital.
Yes.
So, you know, the guys who created Theme Hospital want to scratch an itch. They wanted to be able to play Theme Hospital on a modern computer.
Yes.
So that kind of thing. And they wanted to get it out there so that other people can contribute as well. I think that at a really base level, that's what most people... Same with, like, Linus.
Yeah.
I've created this thing. It won't be very big and, you know... But here it is anyway.
I mean, he's one of those people who's turned a hobby into a living. And I can sort of understand the people who, you know, get a full-time job out of it continuing to do stuff. But
Alan.
Yeah. But it's a good case in point. Alan has a full-time job doing stuff around Ubuntu, which he won't tell us.
But then again, you also... sorry, Tony, you carry on. I won't interrupt you quite yet.
No, you can finish my point if you would like.
I'm not sure if it was the same one.
The point is, but you still do this and you still do some other activities in the Ubuntu community.
Yes, and you still spent several years before you got the job doing a lot of stuff around Ubuntu.
Are you normal in canonical?
Very different.
Is it? I can understand why people working on Ubuntu wouldn't want to work on Ubuntu in the evenings, maybe, but is that, do people find that, or?
It depends. There are, you know, you've got, okay, so there are people who are working on open source or working in open source projects because they're aiming to get for a career option in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or they're working on it because it just scratches an itch and it's something that is a hobby and is a complete aside to what they do on a daily basis, or because they just enjoy it. You know, for me, it was, I just enjoyed it. I quite enjoyed doing it. And then there was the opportunity to go and work for them and so on. And there are quite a large number of people who work for Canonical who are, in inverted commas, from the community.
Yeah.
So you've got people like Sebastian Becker, Didier Roche, and Stefan Graeber, who work for Canonical but were in the community beforehand and are very passionate about community. And now they work at Canonical, they still are passionate about the community. And they're still, you know, decisions they make and their actions within the company are still always conscious of the community impact and making sure that what they do is, in unison with what the community want. That's not the case for everyone, of course, because some people didn't come from the community. Some people were hires from outside, you know, people who were companies we bought or, you know, we acquired or whatever.
So what was it about Ubuntu rather than Debian for example? Why did you start contributing to Ubuntu rather than Debian?
It's not all about me, is it?
No, but yeah, well, let's do you first.
All right. Okay. So I've said this before. I got into Ubuntu because Hugo told me Ubuntu was quite good, and I had a look at it and I agreed it was quite good. And I got into the community side of it because I found it easier to get into and easier to contribute to Ubuntu than Debian. I found Debian very abrasive back in 2004. Right. And I found it almost impossible to get involved as someone who isn't a developer. Whereas in like 2005-06, I was providing support for new users and answering technical questions, which is something that I wouldn't even have thought of doing. I mean, if Ubuntu hadn't come along, maybe I would have contributed to Debian. I don't know.
Yeah.
Mark, what about you?
Well, I suppose with Ubuntu specifically, it came out just as I was getting into Linux. I was into open source for a bit before I started actually using Linux, but I was sort of playing around and I'd used some other Debian-based stuff, and the way that Debian worked made a lot of sense to me in terms of, you know, apt and in the installer and things like that. But I sort of wanted something that was a bit less horrible from a usability point of view, and Ubuntu seemed to be trying to do that. So I started using it, and it had Kubuntu as well, which was basically the best KDE-based distribution there was.
Okay, but why not go and join a theatre group or play in a band?
Now play in a band, that's a good one, because that's something which I did for a bit.
Okay, so, and you did student radio and things
and
as well?
And I did student radio.
So how come you ended up spending a lot of your free time doing Ubuntu stuff, or at least some of it, as opposed to being in a band or being on the radio?
I think the reason that I spend a lot of time doing Ubuntu is because Ubuntu I can do on my computer and I don't have to rely on other people for me to be able to do things. Whereas when you're in a band, you have to get a group of people together and you have to keep them all motivated. And
is that not something that has to happen in a Linux distribution?
Not for an individual.
That's the thing. I mean, there's a massive community, and if I want to, you know, do some coding, then I can just turn on my computer and do some coding. But if I want to play a song with the rest of my band, I have to make sure that they're all going to be in the rehearsal studio on that day, and they're all going to be able to pay for it, and they're all going to have their instruments with them.
Have you not seen those people who have like the big drum on their back and the cymbals on their knees? They don't need anybody else.
They do. Trust me, they do. So answering your question about why not a theatre group or a band, I can't play any musical instruments. But
Ignore the talent barrier for a minute.
He does anyway.
Well, that doesn't stop me now, does it? In terms of not doing something else, I am similar to many other geeks in that terrifically shy, not very particularly socially brilliant. And sitting behind a screen and typing at people is tremendously easier than going out and talking to people in the big blue room, and especially standing on a stage. I've somewhat overcome some of that over the years. I know, it's all a front.
Okay. Wow, it's getting quite deep.
Yeah,
and personal.
So I think that's the case for a lot of people. There's also that feeling that you can contribute and nobody will judge you based on things like what you look like. Mm. So the color of your skin, your sex, you can, in inverted commas, hide via a nickname of some kind. Mm. You can you can have any sexual orientation and nobody really cares. It's not something that matters. As long as you can write code or you know, support people or translate or do something that is worth contributing. I think that's why a lot of people get into it, is it's a way to do something worthwhile without having the social problem of other people actually seeing you and making judgments based on, you know, what you look like, for example.
And fitting it around things, as you say, you don't have to, well, aside from a podcast, you don't have to be in the same room at the same time as everybody else.
Yeah. Well, even for a podcast, you don't have to. We choose to.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can sit at home after you've done whatever work that you've done. You know, you look at someone like Neil Wallace, who by day is a dentist, and then goes home and writes, you know, Qt software in the evening. Not, you know, Qt software. I mean, like Qt. Yeah, Qt software in the evening. And, you know, that's... I'm sure that some of that is an escape. The fact that he's writing dental software doesn't mean he escapes very much. But...
Scratching an itch.
Yeah, exactly.
Or drilling a cavity, as he likes to call it.
Nicely done. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's the whole scratching itch and you know, getting something out of something you don't do during the day.
Laura, how about you?
It's a good question.
Yeah, so you've had quite a few minutes to prepare for it.
I did, and I've forgotten what I was going to say.
What about you then, Tony?
I kind of got into it by accident, sort of, because I was through Hans Lug and then the podcast and stuff. But actually, I started using Linux and Debian and got people at work into using Ubuntu. So I guess in a most explicit way, that's my contribution. Mm. The podcast I do because I enjoy it, and you're quite good fun, the lot of you. So,
aww,
great hug. Yeah.
No, you're right. I refer you to my earlier comment.
yeah, and with the podcast, to some extent, it just happens to be about Ubuntu.
Yeah.
If you'd started doing a podcast on something else on open source, probably. Same effects. We talk about open source, not specifically just Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Can you see yourself? Sorry, let's go back, Tony. What about yourself? Why?
It is a very good question. It was because of, I went to open source because of the technicalities of it. You know, you could do what you like with open source. You can tweak your system endlessly, and I was geeky and enjoyed that. And I read Richard Stallman's theses on these things, and
hey, you read them.
I am. It was me.
You're that guy.
I read the GPL at one point as well.
I read the BSD license.
Which version?
2, because it was that long ago. 3 didn't exist at the time. And so I kind of got into it for technical reasons, but I guess the reason I've stuck around is, you know, the community. Yeah. I enjoyed Ubuntu as a distro over others because it mostly just worked. It worked a lot better than Debian at the time, and I've just stuck with it because it hasn't annoyed me enough to go anywhere else.
That's a ringing endorsement of a distro.
Well, there are
it hasn't people, annoyed me enough.
There are people who, you know, leave distros because the buttons move from one side of the window to another. So, you know, and it hasn't annoyed me enough, and I'm still able to do what I want with it, and therefore I've stuck with it. And it's an even more popular platform, so I can get a wider range of software for it, perhaps, than I could 3 or 4 years ago. But it is kind of, I think there's kind of the community and the engagement, and I mean, John O'Bacon's buzzwords will be going off all over the place now, but the fact that there are people who listen in to this show, for example, and write in, or I can go to a conference, and even if I don't know anybody there, if I see somebody with an Ubuntu t-shirt on, I can probably go up to them and have a conversation about it. And
get your photos taken with them.
Well, yes, or they get their photos taken with me.
One
way or the other. But yeah, so it's an insight. And to be honest, you know, the last year or so, I've kind of broadened my horizons and things, and have, you know, got back into things like Doctor Who, which I was part of the community a long time ago, but stopped going and getting involved in. And it's not all that dissimilar, really. It's just the fact that you can stand around chatting with people who are into the same thing as you.
Mm. People who are obsessive. It doesn't really matter what they're obsessive about.
There's not a lot of crossover, though.
No, I'm always quite surprised that there are a small minority, but yes. Yeah. And it really just seems like it's, as long as you can have a conversation with somebody about it, it's like football fans who will sit and talk about how their particular team is doing in the league, which players are doing well, which ones are doing badly.
It's like metal fans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's commonality that's the important thing.
When I used to go to the pub before all of this with my friends, before I was married and had kids.
This is better for you.
Yeah, maybe not financially. My social circle of like real world friends, we used to go down the pub and they would show me a red card if I talked about computers. And it would be like they'd pull out a yellow card if it was like getting close.
Get to say anything?
Yeah. If it was like, oh, did you see this website? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, this was before smartphones and before, you know, you could just pull out a phone and show them Wikipedia and answer a question or something. You're having a conversation. If I mentioned anything about computers, it was red card.
Wow. These are your
they
friends.
Were, yeah, yeah. Right. Okay. I mean, it was kind of done in a jokey way, but they meant shut up. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's common. I think there are a number of people who are comfortable being in a pub talking about football, but they're very uncomfortable talking about anything deeply technical because it's boring.
Yeah.
Whereas I could sit at home and chat with you guys via, you know, the internet, or come to your house and chat about stuff that I enjoy talking about, and I don't get red carded for talking about it.
I've just thought of an idea for next season, though.
See, red card Alan.
See, what really got me into it, actually, was the community stuff, because I came along to Lug Radio Live. Tony had been the first year and it looked like fun. So I came along the second year, a bit shy because I've no idea what was going on, but really enjoyed it and went back and volunteered the years afterwards and had an amazing time. And it was just the kind of buzz of it all, and people talking, and people, some of it was the kind of unconference thing because it's just so friendly and informal and just free. People did it for free.
Collectively nice bunch of people. Yeah. The people, and I don't know what it is about, you know, that there are collectively nice people who gravitate towards each other in communities like Odd Camp and Lug Radio, and also within the Ubuntu community. There are nice people who gravitate towards each other. Okay, there are, you know, people we don't particularly like,
eccentric,
and they can go away their own way.
Right.
But, you know, we like to surround ourselves with people who we enjoy company with. And
just like when we went to Odd Camp this year, just walking into the room and people just say, oh, buy your drink. Because
I didn't get that.
But it wasn't just about the drink. It was the fact that you'd walk in and these were people that you saw once a year.
Yeah.
Right.
And you talk to once a year, and yet you'd be talking to each other like you were best mates.
Yeah.
It was, it's just really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things like Twitter kind of help keep that communication.
Yes.
During
the fact that there's still a Lug Radio IRC channel long after the show is, you know, mort.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you're if you are involved in the Ubuntu community, or why not?
You are, because you're listening to this show.
Well, that's what I was getting at. you can send us a sort of email and tell us why you do it. Why do you contribute? Maybe you don't contribute, and maybe there's a reason why you don't contribute, and you could tell us about that as well. Send us an email or via any of the other ways which we mentioned at the end of the episode, and we'd love to hear from you.
And now it's time for the bit about Ubuntu.
Wow, that's a big voice.
Shouting trousers on this evening.
The Unity team are working on a fix to improve performance for full screen games.
That's timely, isn't it?
Yes. So this is some clever thing where it says, oh, there's a game that's full screen, I won't worry about compositing then.
Yes, basically. Unredirected Windows.
Why is it a problem normally?
Well, because so directed Windows. Did I say this before? I think this
yes,
sounds familiar.
Did. Let's not have that again. It's basically when it detects that there's a full screen app going on, like a game, give over all the resources to that window, so you don't bother.
So it's
doing
not still
any...
drawing a wobbly window in the background, which is eating all of your GPU.
Yeah, that's the idea. And because this is coming up for release of Steam, and you know more and more games are coming out, it makes sense to. And Timo has blogged about it and put a package in a PPA and said, hey, go for it, test this. And we found some regressions already. And,
cool.
We've got some fixes for those as well. So there's going to be a new Compiz and Unity coming for 12.04 and 12.10.
Oh, cool. Right. So it's backported.
Yeah, this is all backported for 12.04 for Steam and 12.10 because, yeah, some people have upgraded from 12.04.
Very cool.
The Dell XPS 13 Developer Edition, the laptop produced from Project Sputnik, has been released in the USA, I think, and Canada.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
I think it's USA.
As long
and
as it's in Canada.
What's that all about?
Nicely done.
Hi, Emma Jane.
It's a laptop, an Ultrabook, no less.
Yes.
A 13-inch Ultrabook, which was previously part of Project Sputnik, where they would Dell and Canonical got together and built an image for that specific hardware, which is tuned for the hardware, aiming at DevOps, who currently buy MacBook Airs.
And it's also got a couple of cool little tools on. There's the developer profiles thing, where you can say, I am an Android developer, and it will set up your environment like an Android developer. And there's the cloud launcher, is it called, where it basically will create a cloud of virtual machines on your laptop, so you can develop like you're developing on a cloud.
Yeah, so you could be offline and develop your cloud app locally and then publish it to your corporate cloud when you're done.
So you get an i7 CPU, an Intel CPU, 8 gigs of RAM, and a 256 gig solid state
for the low,
disk.
Low price of about...
It's about $1,500.
Yeah.
$1,500.
It's a premium laptop. I mean, it's
like right high end in
it's,
the.
It's not
the
aimed
ultra,
at, you know, people who are buying netbooks. Mm-hmm. It's aimed at people who are buying MacBook Airs.
Yeah.
That's the goal, is to win those people back over.
Yeah.
To Linux rather than OS X.
Hmm. Right. Okay, but a nice laptop anyway. I might get one.
if somebody
gives me one Christmas.
He won't.
Okay. Metacity, which is a long-forgotten window manager, will no longer be included in Ubuntu Images. That's because it's been replaced, essentially.
By Compiz and Nux.
Yes.
Nux. So I won't still have to look at it and go, Metacity. No, Metacity.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you'll never have that problem ever again. We're doing it just for that reason.
Excellent.
That people mispronounce it. That's all.
Good.
Can we get rid of Linux as well?
Linux, you mean?
Yeah, that's it.
Linux.
My name is Linus, and I pronounce Linux as Linux.
Juicy Pakkanen has blogged about libcolumbus, a searching library that will allow error-tolerant searches in Unity's HUD.
HUD.
So this means that if you mash the keyboard a bit halfway through typing what you're searching for, it'll say, "Ah, oh, you probably meant this, so I'll show you the results for this."
Mm.
Which is quite handy.
Yeah.
Yes. Probably.
Stats for app downloads in the Ubuntu Software Center are showing a rise in popularity of Unity 3D games.
Mm. Previously, the number one thing people bought was a Minecraft launcher. And now there's a bunch of games at the top.
Oh, nice.
And we've talked about this a number of times. Unity 3D now has an export to Linux option.
Yeah.
And it makes it easier for developers to port games to Linux. So they can port them, export them out to Linux, send them to... the Software Center and sell them.
Cool.
Hooray for them.
Good for people who like games.
And finally, not about Ubuntu.
Matthew Garrett has released his Shim bootloader, which will allow Linux distributions to boot on machines with UEFI Secure Boot enabled.
Cool.
Yay,
and this
Matthew.
Is signed by Microsoft as well. So if it's a Windows 8 certified machine, which is locked down to only boot Microsoft signed stuff, it will work on that.
Mm. Good work, Matthew.
The fact that anybody can download it and install it, does that not effectively bypass the whole point of signed
things? No, because you things? Basically, you have the key for your distribution on your install media. So you put it in and it runs this shim, which is signed, so that's okay. And then it says you can install a new key for something and you say, all right, install the one off my install media. And then it'll check that what you're booting is the thing for that key, which is what you're installing off your install media. So if someone then tries to change that, it won't boot because it won't match the key.
So as long as your install media is okay and hasn't been compromised, you're right.
Yes.
Okay. But somebody can still set up Tiny Sofa Linux and set up their own installer that will install on a Windows 8 machine.
Yeah, I mean, someone could give you a CD with Malware Linux on, with the key for Malware Linux, and say, yeah, just use that key, and it'll still boot Malware Linux and own your machine.
That's what I was getting at, I think. Yes, but also people can do their own thing.
And at that point, you've stuck a CD in and installed software on your machine.
Yeah.
It's not some random binary that came in a Java advert, you know, in your browser that's trying to compromise your machine. You physically stuck the media in your machine and did that to it.
Right, so you're to blame.
Yes.
For not checking the SHA-1 sums.
Yes.
Right. Okay, and that's all the end of the bit about and not about Ubuntu.
And it's time for the feedback. Craig Lynch Bloss has been upgrading his desktop and has a question for the community.
Which everyone's pointing to me at to read.
You're good at reading.
Okay. I can't.
I'll go to the
That
should be an A.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
A few releases ago, I upgraded my desktop and I have major problems with the result and end up doing a wipe and load. I like the sound of that.
Yeah,
wipe and load.
Good,
After an upgrade from 1204 to 1210, I am again left with a mostly useless desktop. It looks like the window manager doesn't start correctly. In fact, Compiz crashes, and I sometimes get the option to send a report, which doesn't work. I have almost no GUI access, but I can get a shell by pressing Ctrl-Alt-T. But if I try to interact too much with the desktop, the whole system will lock up. Ah! Someone scrolled the screen.
Sorry. How did I do that?
Oh man, what was I? I can get a shell if I do Ctrl-Alt-T, but if I try to interact too much with the desktop, the whole system will lock up and I need to do a hard reset. That sounds unfortunate.
Yeah.
In my attempt to not repeat the mistakes of the past, I've tried to reach out to the Ubuntu community, but I've not had much luck. When I log into the #Ubuntu channel on Freenode, a few hours in the evening here, and ask for help, I may have had a couple of hints, but no real help, and the signal-to-noise ratio seems quite high. Maybe I live and work in the wrong time zone. UTC plus 13. Isn't that in the middle of the Pacific?
Well, I looked this up. There's a bit in the middle of the Pacific, which is over the international dateline, but there's some islands which want to be on the other side.
Okay.
Not important
for him. I've posted a question on Launchpad, Googled, and checked that the Unity plugin is installed and enabled. As far as I can tell, it's somehow related to NVIDIA drivers. So what's the best way to get help for someone in my part of the world?
So it's not so much...
Oh, it is Hawaii.
Well, no, sorry, I added that.
Oh, okay.
I looked up, so I thought I'd have a look and see who might have an Ubuntu loco in that area.
Mm.
And
in the middle of the Pacific.
In the middle of the Pacific. And Hawaii would be, you know, forward a day, but only an hour forward, relatively, if that makes sense.
Right.
So, yes. And there, yeah, so there's a Hawaii loco, but I'm not sure how active it is. There's also an Alaska loco.
Two extremes of the thermometer there, aren't
they? Yeah, but if you're in a mid-Pacific loco and you'd like to help out Craig, then
Craig, he's got a couple of good points saying he's tried to put questions on Launchpad, which are, you know, answers.launchpad.net. Oh, yeah. It's a good place to put it. Hasn't had any luck.
Well, I've seen some people are asking, you know, for more information and making suggestions as to what it could be. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he's provided information, and then it goes quiet, which is about my experience of a lot of Launchpad threads. We need X, Y, and Z. Okay, here's X, Y, and Z. Silence.
So my first reaction would be ask a question on Ask Ubuntu. He's Googled and found another question that might be it. I would say create a new one and outline what's been done and paste whatever logs on Ask Ubuntu, and that would be the best place to do it.
Why do we have so many places that people can go for support?
Because people like different things. You know, there are people who absolutely hate forums, all web-based things, and thus mailing lists are their favourite. There are people who hate real-time chat because they feel it's a time sink to sit there staring at a screen waiting for someone to reply to them and would rather paste a gobful of text in somewhere and say, here's my question, and then wait for the answer, in which case, mailing lists are for them. And there are some people who just love web-based forums, crazy though they seem. So Ask Ubuntu, I would go to Ask Ubuntu and ask a question and put the question in there and someone will get back to you.
Is there a specific IRC channel for graphics help?
There is. There's Ubuntu-X, where the X developers hang out. And usually that's a kind of last resort. If you can't get a question answered from someone else in the community, you go there. I've done that a few times when I've had, major problems with video drivers. But generally, Ask Ubuntu, I would say, is the first port of call because it's pretty high quality and you generally will get an answer. And if you don't get an answer, the really nice thing about Ask Ubuntu is your question will sit there, and if nobody answers it, after a few days have passed, you can offer a bounty for the question, or someone else can offer a bounty, and some of your karma, your points that you've got, you offer to somebody else to say, look, I'll give anyone 200 points if they answer this question. I tried that on one of mine. I asked the question, nobody answered it, so I offered like 500 points, and then Colin Watson answered it. I was like, yeah, you win.
Yes, who was sitting in the desk opposite you?
No.
Okay, well, best of luck with that. I hope you find some good solutions, Craig. And Chris Giltnane has written in to ask,
with more and more games coming to Ubuntu, should or could Ubuntu do more to support mice and joysticks out of the box?
So it is special gaming joysticks.
Some of those gaming joysticks that have like a bazillion buttons and hair triggers and all that kind of stuff.
I've got a gaming mouse which works out of the box. I'm not sure.
Well, I think it's mapping the buttons and all that kind of stuff, because a lot of them on Windows come with a GUI that lets you map this button to that function in the game or to this keyboard press.
Yes. So you can like macros and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of stuff as well. And so, I don't think we really have something like that on Linux. I know someone recently posted a screenshot on online of KDE and the KDE Control Center, which does have a joystick thing.
Yes, it's really good with gamepads, any gamepad I've ever connected up. I mean, it's been a GameCube one and a Wii controller, and it just recognizes them exactly.
Knows what they are, and you can calibrate them and all that kind of stuff and figure out what the buttons do. But and in GNOME-based distros, there's a joystick -GTK app that does the same kind of thing, but it's not on there by default.
Right. Oh, okay.
And in there, and I don't think it lets you map buttons to do certain things. It's nowhere near as comprehensive as the apps on Windows are. So yeah, maybe that's an opportunity. Someone should develop an app that actually manages those gaming mice.
Mm. And as he says, the more games coming to Ubuntu, then there's going to be more and more demand for that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, get on that then.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us via our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, where you can find our voicemail numbers that nobody uses, Twitter feed, Facebook and Google Plus pages, and IRC channel.
Founders, please.
Let us know what you think of the show, or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu, the community around it, how you contribute, and that kind of thing. Join us on Tuesday, the 18th of December, for our next live broadcast, the last one ever.
And it's the last one for the... What?
Sorry. You weren't listening, were you?
Only half listening there.
Not last to the last one ever, as far as we're aware, yet.
Maybe.
Decisions like that have not been made.
Oh, come on, we need some feedback.
But it is the last one before Christmas, so...
Yeah, if you want us to come back after Christmas, send us nice emails before the next show.
I'm sorry, but the world is going to end at the end of December, so it is the last one ever.
I've forgotten that, yeah.
See? Again?
Yeah, the whole kind of Mayan calendar. Yeah. That's the end of the world. 2012. So we clearly can't be doing an episode if the world has been destroyed.
But Peter Curry next year as well.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's quite sad. So it is the last one of this season, and it's the last one before Christmas, and we usually try and line up something for our Christmas episodes. And yes, we might have something in store. And we're going to go and review our predictions that we made last year.
Oh, yes.
That's always fun. Seeing
how wrong we were.
Yes.
Or in my case, how right we were.
You've already done it.
Have you checked yours?
No, I remember what his was, actually.
Yeah.
Save it for the show.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.